So I'm going to be doing a reading from Twigs and Branches of Bodhinyana. And much gratitude to Tonkovilo for translating. And then we kind of threw it back and forth a couple times. And this is what we've come up with. He did all the work. This is Ajahn Tongjan. And it turns out that I just found out that I actually met him back in 2010 when I was in Thailand with Lumpur and Ajahn Amaro and Rhoda. And he was at Ajahn Sopa's monastery in Pak Chong. So I didn't know that when we decided to do this talk. So my inspiration in Lumpur Cha, I must say, is connected like a bridge with Lumpur Anek. I'm his disciple. He's been my model, the one who has made me who I am, from back when I was still a layman up to when I ordained as a monk. It was due to Lungpur Anek's encouragement that I was exposed to this training in changing one's character from not knowing the ways of the world to having the circumspection and good deportment befitting a samana and to having the capacity to enter an assembly or society as such. My roots are in the backwoods and farm country of simple farmers and country folk, chasing grasshoppers, shooting lizards with slingshots, eating frogs, eating toads, raising cows, raising water buffalo, just acting like anybody else from Isan. I didn't know the worth of being a good person. I didn't have any kind of education, but I did have the good fortune of living close to a Buddhist monastery until good habits could truly be born in my heart. Before Lumpur Anek would ordain me as a monk, he suggested I entrust myself into the care of Wat Pa Phong as a way to train me in the Dhamma Vinaya and Khor Wat Batipat. It was there that I came to be inspired by the forest monastery environment. It was different from the monastery in my home village, which had familiar and worldly associations from when I was still a kid up until I was 18 or 19 years old. When I came to Wat Pa Phong and saw the upasaka and upasikas wearing white clothes, wrapped in white, coming to observe the Uposatha Sila, I was impressed. I saw all of their shoes left neatly lined up at the front entrance to the monastery. The lay people wouldn't wear their shoes into the monastery itself out of their respect for the Buddhist religion and for the Dhamma. When I entered the monastery gate and passed beneath the overhanging treetop canopy, my heart became peaceful and cool. I was finally able to pay respects to Lungpur Cha. I noticed monks and novices fanning him from both sides. In those days, there weren't any electric fans to blow away the mosquitoes and the heat. Having never before seen anything like this, I was most impressed. Many people would come and lower themselves and pay respects to Lungpur Cha, and he would display the Patisantara Dhamma, the Dhamma of hospitality, receiving each and every group on and on. His words were really simple, but they weren't ordinary. They were profound. They fed the heart and allowed people to come back to themselves, back to their hearts. They made bad people become good, and they made wicked and evil-minded people become noble people. The lay people that came to the monastery at that time were, for the most part, old and aging. There were only a few younger people. They would come to make offerings and listen to teachings, to the Dhamma. Everyone stayed until dawn. Since I was 18 or 19 at that time, I had to stay until dawn too, because if I had been bold enough to sneak out and go sleep, all of the old folks would have noticed me. When Lungpur Cha would pass through the crowd, everyone would sit with hands held together with wholehearted reverence. I had been going to the monastery in my home village since I was 9 years old and had never seen anything like this. Washing and cleaning our Krupa Ajahn's feet, I had never seen such a thing. But here I saw the monks and novices performing such service for Lungpu. Some would go and fetch the water, others would scrub his feet, and still others would clean them off. In each and every activity, his disciples would hold their hands up together in Anjali, in such a beautiful way that it went straight to the heart. They did it with such true and real devotion. This was the power, the magic spell, which made people who had never seen such things become impressed. It's not, however, just singular to that place and time. If there is Korwat Battipat like that, then wherever it is, people who are not yet impressed become impressed, and for people who are already impressed, their inspiration increases. After having seen the monks and novices Upatak Lungpu, I thought, that man has a lot of boon. As for me, I only have a little boon. How about if I ordain? How about if I try to be like that? This was my impression regarding these things I had never known or seen before. Following this, I decided to come and ordain as a bhikkhu in the Buddhist religion. Before I could take full ordination, though, I had to train myself for many years, starting out by coming and being in Anagarika with Lumpur Anek, keeping 5 precepts, keeping the Uposatha Day precepts, the 8 precepts, going against the stream of the world, going against the flow of kilesa, tanha raga, going against the stream of loving and liking. I decided that once I could see for myself that I had sufficiently gone against these currents, I would come and ordain. In the old days, Wat Pa Phong didn't have many branch monasteries. Lungpo Cha was not yet an upajaya, someone who could ordain others, so I had to go and ordain at a monastery near my home. After ordaining, however, I came back to enter into the monastic community of Wat Pa Phong. My upasampada, that's the monk's ordination, was in 1973, and I came to live at Wat Pa Phong in 1976. Because I had been living in a branch monastery with a small community of only 3 or 4 monastics, I had to adjust myself and change my heart in many ways, as there was a large sangha here. In the old days, the monks and novices at Wat Pa Phong were really good at smoking cigarettes. If a lay person came and offered some, Lungpu would pass them around. There came a time, though, when we had to stop. The reason for stopping was that some of the Krupa Ajahns went to visit Lungpur Buddhadasa at Suan Mok, and they saw that the monks at Suan Mok didn't smoke cigarettes. After that, we had a Sangha meeting and decided that we should take up those things which were good about Suan Mok, for example, abstaining from chewing betel nut and from smoking cigarettes. Lungpur Jan of Wat Ban Gao Luang was the instigator of this initiative and did so because there had been some problems. People who were coming to ordain included various government officials, sons from wealthy families having had status, poor people, and country folks and farmers. When they would smoke, they would break up into various cliques and small groups. The group having had some status would smoke the good ones. The group that had had no status would smoke the bad ones. In the end, it was agreed upon to stop smoking cigarettes altogether, because we were supposed to be examples, people who would guide others' hearts and minds in the direction of what was appropriate and not towards what was inappropriate. We understood things and so should lead the lay people to stop as well. Once we stopped smoking cigarettes, it was easier to look after things and the routines and protocols improved. Another thing which was brought back from Suan Mok was their version of the morning and evening chanting. Lungpur Buddhadasa was the foremost scholar of our era. He was an expert in the Pali language and understood the principles of practice as well. In time, the morning and evening chanting books, as well as tape recordings from Suan Mok, came to be adopted by Wat Pa Phong. The books, which came to have a picture of Lungpo Cha on the cover, were distributed to the monks, novices, and lay people and were chanted from. The first edition of the morning and evening chanting books came out around 1973, so I was ordained together with at the same time as these morning and evening chanting books. After that, they were reprinted, enlarged, and given out, especially to all the branch monasteries of Wat Pa Phong. Then, wherever you went, you could all chant the same thing together as descendants of Bodhinyana. It's noticeable how the laity, the Buddhist assembly of householders and those gone forth practitioners, can go anywhere and be as one together. It's like a bo tree. Anywhere you go, it's still a bo tree. Its leaves are bo leaves. Its fruit is bo fruit. It's like how the original Bodhi tree has died, but the Bodhi fruit, the children, and the Bodhi grandkids are still being born, and after this, there will continue to be more. Wherever one goes, both in Thailand and in other countries, one only has to look inside the monastery or center to know this is an offshoot of the Bodhinyana. The kuti I stayed in at that time was right in front of Lungpu's kuti. Whenever there were senior monks or lay people who had come to pay respects to Lungpu, I was the one who had to receive them and lead them over to pay respects. If Lungpu wasn't there, I had the duty of receiving them in his stead. Once I became familiar with upatthakking, I could do it all. If a lay person had come to make some offerings, I had to reflect on whether they should be kept for Lungpu, given away, or given to the Sangha. This reminds me of a particular incident. The trouble started with a pocket knife in Lungpu's yam, his shoulder bag. When I saw it, I wanted it. It was able to do so many different things. It had a can opener, a nail clipper, scissors. Because I was from the backwoods and farm country, I had never seen something like this before, and I really wanted it. I tried to find some way in which I could come to own it. I would walk Jongram and try to think of some way that I could be able to find the right time to ask Lungpu for it. Because there was only one of them, I absolutely couldn't let any of the other monks or novices know about its existence. Finally, one day, after having given Lungpu his bath, I had the chance to be with him alone. I then bowed and asked to have that knife of his. Lungpu answered, "It's mine. Why do you want it?" I thought, Lungpu would give away other things which were worth more than the knife, like a watch, for instance. Why can't he give me this simple knife? Lungpu is full of kilesa. Why is he so stuck on things like this? When Lungpu answered like that, my plans were shaken up. I thought it would be so simple. I had wasted 4 or 5 full days proliferating about this knife. I couldn't think anymore. I didn't want to think anymore. 3 days after that, Lungpu called me over and said, Chan, take away this knife. This was something really impressive, which I won't forget. If you wanted something, he wouldn't give it to you. When you were free from wanting, then he would give it. If you wanted to go, he wouldn't let you go. When you were free from wanting, then he would allow you to go. But if you didn't want to go, he would make you go. When I still lived with my parents, they would let me do whatever I wanted. But once I ordained, I couldn't follow my heart's whims. Lungpu would toramon his disciples' kilesas. Toramon is torture. The kilesas would come up, but the disciples didn't know themselves. They were still infatuated with taking things easy. This was another impressive thing which I recall. Regarding shaving, in the old days, razors had to be sharpened and honed to keep them sharp. It wasn't like these days with disposable ones. One razor could shave more than 10 monks and novices. Most monks who came to ordain didn't know how to sharpen a blade, but I already had the skill from having sharpened axes and machetes before I ordained. So thus it ended up that I was able to come and assist in shaving Lungpu Cha. When Lungpu was going to be shaved, I had the job of sharpening the blade and making sure no strands of hair were left scattered about. I had to gather up and save each and every hair. There was an old monk who came to make holy powder for making into amulets by mixing up leftover rice from Lungpu's bowl, flowers which the laity had offered in ceremonies, and in addition to these, various other ingredients. The old monk had us come and dry all these out, grind them into powder, mix it with latex glue, and then press it into block casting molds. He then had us dry them out again in the sun and instructed us to put them next to Lung Pu's seat. Lung Pu quickly gave them all away to the lay people, and when they were all gone, he ordered us to stop. By and by, that old monk would make more. This is how there came to be the holy powder or the amulets of Lung Pu Cha. Although he wouldn't allow us to make them, and though I never saw he himself perform any kind of magic ritual, it's difficult to break some ties of their superstitions in omens and magic. Before I ordained, I was the same. Although young monks and novices, children and young people in general want these things, some very senior Mahateras still want these things too. This is a matter which is deeply embedded in hearts and minds. So after I had been shaving assistant for some time, I was promoted to having the duty of actually shaving Lung Pu's hair. It was the norm for Kruba Ajahns and lay people to come and ask for Lung Pu's hair, and usually it would all be quickly given away. Finally, one shaving day, no one was there waiting to ask for some of Lung Pu's hair. I thought, has every last person really gotten their fill? As I was shaving him, I was so happy. I thought in my heart, may no other monks come. May no lay people come. May I keep it all. After shaving his head, I respectfully asked him, please excuse me, Lung Pu. Could I please request to have your hair? Lung Pu answered, why would you want to take that? I give you good things. And that's implying the Dhamma teachings. Why don't you want them? You just come and want things which I throw away. I then thought, why is it that when the Kruba Ajahns or lay people come and ask for hair, he gives it to them, but when I ask, he won't allow it? This impressed me. He was afraid we would get deluded by such things, things which had no substance, no real worth. Everything Lung Pu said to us was a teaching, was a point of practice, and everything he did was visible, not hidden. The way we saw him live was our example. Even though he was the one in charge, he would abandon such things, like making sacred objects. In the old days, Lung Pu would chew betel nut. Senior monks would come and ask to have his leftover betel nut, and he would give it to them. The laity would do the same, and he would give it to them. When there would be chewed betel nut juice in his spittoon, some lay people, full of confidence, faith, inspiration, and devotion, would even pick it up and drink it down. But as for me, he wouldn't give me any. He would say, why would you want something as repulsive as that? Another story concerns some holy relics in Lung Pu's yam. I had the duty of washing and looking after the yam. When he would go to house invitations at the homes of lay people, I had to arrange and prepare all the various things he would need to take. For example, 2 face cloths, his special false teeth used for chewing rice, his betel nut chewing teeth, and his teaching teeth. When I listen to recordings of Lung Pu, I can tell if he was wearing his teaching teeth because the sound is so clear. When I saw the holy relic in his yam, I really wanted it, but I wasn't so bold as to ask for it, as I remembered the times when I had asked for his knife and for his cut hair. Those 2 mistakes were enough. One day, after having had the meal, Lung Pu motioned me to come over, calling, Jan, 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 come here, come here. I came over and bowed down at his feet. Lung Pu was standing there with his hands out and said, Uy, this is a holy relic. Take it and protect it well. I was dumbfounded. I was truly speechless and couldn't understand. When I was able to speak, I asked him, please excuse me, Lung Pu, is this really a holy relic? Lung Pu shook his finger at me and said, Oy, is your body really truly your body? Having listened, I raised my hands in full hands in reverence. After some time, Lung Pu sent me off to spend the rains retreat at Tam Seng Pet. Before leaving, he enjoined, live according to the middle. I came to reflect on this teaching of Lung Pu's concerning the character of the Majjhima Patipata for the whole of the rains retreat and on. Whatever comes up, whether it is inspiring or uninspiring, whether it concerns friends, brother monks, or the laity, all of these things, each and every one, can be aids in supporting and building up sati and panya.
Or when you have talked, Ajahn Chah, was that many different times, or was there a longer period of time when you did it?
I did it on many different occasions.
Is there any kind of similar story that you had that was kind of funny you can remember with some of his things or some of his kind of you could talk duties that you kind of.
Not really. When before you start upatthaking Ajahn Chah, then you really have to have a bit more language down, so that feeling, and so that by observing, then you get a sense of what's within bounds and what's not, and so that I tended to keep my eyes and ears open. There's lots of times when you're with him what you have to do is really pay attention to what he wants, what the circumstances are, and wait for cues. You have to be really, it's a real mindfulness training really clue in to make sure that you're getting a decent sense of what he needs, what he wants, and then also what is not appropriate. So then. I had kept my eyes and ears open pretty well. So, I mean, it's not that I'm sure I made mistakes, but the boundaries that I overstepped were all that much. I never asked him for anything. Just never occurred to me to ask Ajahn Chah for anything. Didn't really can't remember it being I think also having seen how just noticing that because Ajahn Chah always tuned in to people, and if you we're coming from a place of aversion or desire, then he invariably, he was ahead of you, so that whenever there was some kind of desire or aversion, then that was a time to be really careful. So it's like Ajahn Chah. The very first time when I chanted the Patimokkha, it's the first time, there's 40 monks in the hall, and the very first time that I chanted it, and then he started cracking jokes, and making fun of my accent, and so I said, so it could party better. So I was chanting like some sort of Tibetan monk. I made a point of, really keep focus. He's trying to rile me, and my duty is to keep my mindfulness and clarity. And then I made a point of, after finishing, then coming over and sitting with Lopo and waiting for him to say something, just to sort of say, I wasn't rattled. So then he, so that, but you know, he would look for occasions to see if you were getting swept up in something, getting caught in some kind of a fantasy or desire or proliferation, you know, some aversion, and he would be unrelenting if you were stuck in some aversion. He wouldn't let you. I wouldn't indulge it. And so that it was inevitably painful if one did. Also, so you know, things like when you know he liked things done in a certain way, so that if he didn't do it in the right way, then or what he felt was the right way, then he would redo it. And it was up to you to pay attention and to mimic that rather than trying to teach him what your right way is. that was a very much a part of the training as well.
Were there any other ways in which he tormented you specifically?
Me specifically, he was pretty, you know, he was pretty kind with me, really. He didn't. I think one, I wasn't. Fairly steady, and so that he didn't really. And he did one time. One time, I wanted to go. I was just like that. If you want to go, he's not going to let you go. And you have to not want to go before he'll let you. Or you know, it's really so that it was a hot season, and I had been he had been cleaning these tanks, these water tanks. It was the filthiest job, and so I was working on that every day and doing that. It was inside this water tank in the hot season, and cleaning them out, and just it was awful. And so I was fed up with that. I was fed up with hot season. I wanted to go off to another monastery to get away. Of course, you can't say that Ajahn Chah. but you have to come up with a really good logic. And he said, just wait, there's no need yet. So he'll sort of deflect it. And of course, that's what happened. But I stewed and stewed until finally it was obvious that I was burning a bit, so he finally let me go. And but anyway, you know, he definitely threw up the mirror and sort of said, "You're restless, you're averse." But in general, he did give me a bad time. I mean, he gave me a bad time once in early days when I was newly come to Wapapong. The chanting was very long in the morning. So it was almost an hour of chanting. So that I could meditate, I didn't come home. And Ajahn Chah would only show up from time to time. It wouldn't be there every day, so he came out one morning. everybody's there, or, you know, or a lot of the people are there. Where's that Prasimo? So, he doesn't usually come on. He's just lazy. Because that got back to me real quick. I said, you're lazy. Tell me the whole song. So that had its desired effect. So I started going to give up. I mean, there was a time when he really did torture me. For over a year, and then it was it was hard, but it wasn't it was quite skillful, and it could possibly have gone on for another almost a year. And I went to Lumpur one day, and after a year or so, and then I was there and just waited, bided my time. Paid respects, and I said, "I think I've learned what you wanted me to learn from this." I think I could be reintegrated into the sangha, and he just sort of looked at me and said, and he's got this kind of sly smile. You give up? I give up. So that then he said, "Okay, yeah. That's all we want." So just that I can give up. I'm willing to put my pride and my sense of self down.
Or did he, when he got fierce with people, was that ever kind of like you were talking about testing, or kind of like he's going to see how they're going to respond? Uh-huh. Was that kind of what he was seeing sometimes? Like, not only just the teaching of, like, you know, putting a person in their place or getting them in their right perspective of mind, but also just how's a student going to react?
Yeah, oh, sure. Sort of. Yeah, definitely.
Generally, he was pretty sensitive to people, and different people required different kind of tools, and some needed blunt objects. I remember, like Joseph saying, he's like, the only times he's been really kind of he had tremendous devotion and respect to Ajahn Chah, but also he's also been on the receiving end of blunt instruments, blunt instruments. And he said, Ajahn Chah's, he's hardly over 5 foot, really, and not a big person. Joseph's like 6'3", and 200, whatever, and big. Big guy. Vietnam vet, Silver Star, not a fearful character. And he said, he said that sometimes on the receiving end of Ajahn Chah's, he's just sort of shaking from fear. He could definitely display power that would be The opposite, of course, is the same as well, where he could charm people like crazy. Remember one time? Oh, it was the what the heck was his name? It was the head of the English Center Trust
for
George Sharp brought his daughter, and she was like 14, and she was, you know, she's 14, and as you know, our father brings her to a Buddhist monastery. She didn't really want to be there. She wanted to be somewhere else. She wanted to be taken to a beach. You know, and I'm sure there had to be somewhere. Or she was waiting for to get through this so that she could get to the promised beach, whatever. But anyway, Ajahn Chah, he recognized that. And of course, she was really, you know, I mean, one is just, you know, she's a shy. It's all very foreign. And as well as, you know, she's a teenager, and her father is sort of brought her there. And remember the first day, you know, she was really held back and was kind of resistant. And I remember after I was with them, Paul, after they recently come, and it was about a day or two, he said, I'll have her bowing before she leaves. And he was just so charming. It's just really warm and drew her in. And it was a really, and then actually it was quite natural without any sort of pushing or anything, but he just drew her in. It's just his kind of kindness, and it's just this incredible warmth that he could, and he could be incredibly fierce. He could be incredibly warm. He could do the whole range.
There was all a genuineness, though, about that, to bring a person to a different place with the Dhamma. I mean, really, it didn't seem like just in the readings or whatever, he was playing people.
He's not just playing with people just to, just as a some kind of power trip or something, or just to be manipulative. Because also he's quite sensitive. I remember when he first went to England, there was the very first time he went to England. You know, it's the first time he's been out of the country, you know, almost the first. You know, he's been down to Bangkok a few times. He's not really been out and about in society. So, and then when he went to England, one of the times while they were there, some of these older British Buddhists. And one of them, a woman had invited them for the meal at her house, apartment, I'm not quite sure where, in London. And she was incredibly excited to be able to do it. She put a tremendous amount of effort into it, and she was very nervous around great teacher, especially in Thai culture, you don't actually, like, as a monk, it's impolite to actually thank people for, you know, to say, oh, thank you. It's more of an even an expression of, if you're going to say something, you say, you know, may you grow in goodness and happiness and that sort of thing. Just like a kind of a code that you can use that's more that is polite with them, but when she had And then he just, and he only knew a couple words in English. And then he actually sort of, thank you. She was just so chuffed, and then had that tomato translate and say, oh, that was the most delicious meal I've had. That was just really sweet. Yeah. And he just saw her nervous and you know, something out of his cultural conditioning, but he just was able to tune in and really do the right thing. Okay, let's have a quick break and come back.